Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson.
I feel humbled by the reaction today. Seems a bit of a joke that you get man of the match for 60 minutes, but I've loved my time playing in this jersey, and you know, unfortunately, it does have to come to an end at some stage. And I'm glad I'm able to go out at home with a big win.
How sweet would it be to sign off with a championship win in Paris?
Yeah, winning is, you know, it's one thing playing in this jersey, but it's another thing altogether winning in this jersey. And we've built a big standard, and this crop of players, you know, is capable of doing great things. And we have to start that next week and try and win a second championship as this unit of players.
Thanks for all the memories at Lansdowne Road. Good luck next week.
Thank you to everyone here. It's absolutely incredible.
Brian O'Driscoll there signing off at the end of his last game playing for Ireland on the home turf of the Aviva Stadium in the match against Italy last Saturday. Although, as he made reference to there is of course another game to be played against the French in Paris later today. It has to be said that there was lots of coverage of the career of Brian O'Driscoll on the airwaves last weekend. John Bowman devoted his entire programme to the outgoing number 13 last Sunday morning. In this excerpt from the archives, his parents, Frank and Geraldine, remember the little boy who, until he hit his teens, was always a bit small for his age.
I remember his first game very well. He was playing for Willow Park against Terenure College over in Terenure. And he played on the wing that day. And as far as I can remember, he scored, I think, 3 or 4 tries. And certainly a couple of parents began to take a bit of notice and say, who is this new guy?
Even at Junior Cup level, he was really very small. He played scrum half as a sub on the Junior Cup team. But he grew a lot between his 15th and 16th birthdays. In fact, we had markings on the wall in the kitchen. And between his 15th and 16th birthdays, he grew 6 inches. So after that, as an under 16-year-old, he was beginning to be what I suppose one would call you normal size for a 16-year-old.
Looking back, I would probably think that one of the most exciting experiences I had was when Brian played his very first schoolboy international in Lansdowne Road against England. I remember that Ger and I were both feeling, you know, very emotional about it. And on driving to the ground, a thought struck me. And I said to Ger, do you realise that there are only 15 sets of parents who are feeling the same emotion as we are today in Ireland?
Things changed for Brian, and as Frank said, they changed for us too. I remember shortly after Paris 2000 being introduced to somebody and they said, this is Geraldine O'Driscoll. She used to be Frank O'Driscoll's wife. She's now Brian O'Driscoll's mother. In Brisbane, after the first test, we were coming home from the match, which was in the Gabba, and the system was that they bussed you to the game and away from the game. We were sitting on the bus, surrounded by English, Welsh, Scottish and Irish people, and minding our own business down at the back, when suddenly the whole bus burst into song and they started singing Waltzing O'Driscoll. We just gave each other a little nudge, said nothing, and it was actually very emotional.
Frank and Geraldine O'Driscoll, as heard on last week's Bowman Sunday. A few hours later on Sunday with Miriam, we also heard from two of his friends and former teammates, Shane Horgan and Ronan O'Gara, about some of their fondest memories on the playing field and down the back of the team bus with Brian.
Some of my best memories, and myself and Ronan have both have great memories of playing in different games with Brian, but some of my best memories are actually around the games and you know, even on the way to training and sitting at the back of the bus with Ronan and Brian there and chatting away and after games and dinners after Big Six Nations, and those memories are really special, and we were privileged to have
Miriam,
those as well.
If the truth be known, Miriam, Shane used to sit at the back right hand side of the bus and Brian on the back left hand. The two of them used to be giggling on the way to most games, and I was trying to focus in front of them. The two lads hadn't a worry in the world. They were having great fun and laughing, and all was brilliant. It was brilliant days. It was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, so we're.
Well, that's because we knew we didn't have to kick any goals, you know. We just had we could just relax and play the game and roll and kick the goals.
Yeah, that's pressure. But look, you both managed to go on and carve out really great careers for you. Isn't the real worry for people is that when you have a career like you've all had and Brian's had central as a player, that when that comes to an end, you almost panic about what you're going to do. Would you advise him, or what advice have you both given him?
I think Shane will know as much, because Shane obviously knows him on a daily basis from training in Leinster, and that is a different dynamic. I know Brian from the test player, but I'd be very close to him as a friend. But, you know, if Brian O'Driscoll can't get his head around retiring, then no one in Irish rugby can, because he's had a phenomenal career. He's been the best player there's ever had been. He'll walk into whatever he wants, but yet Brian, being the modest person he is, he worries about that.
You just said,
the fall-off is huge. That's the only thing. The fall-off is immense, and the actual not having a game or the competition the following Saturday, I struggle with that still, you know, because you're just looking for where am I going to get challenged next? How can I play? You know, so it's just from that point, I think he will obviously struggle, but that's natural. But I think he'll just turn his attention to something else and find a thrill with that.
And when you find that a struggle, Ronan, you're thinking about when might the next game be, how do you solve that for yourself? How do you make yourself feel better about that?
I usually turn on the kettle and have a cup of tea and talk to Jessica. It's as boring as that, Miriam, believe me.
Ronan O'Gara and Shane Horgan talking to Miriam O'Callaghan last Sunday.
Horrific. Absolutely horrific. Just even thinking about it the other day, I really got so upset. There was, to me, constant beatings, and I'm sure a lot of the girls who were with me would certainly agree with that. I remember a case where a girl was locked into a furnace. It seemed to be for more than 2 days, and you could hear her howling.
That was Christine Buckley talking about her experiences at Golden Bridge on the Gay Byrne show back in 1992. Her death this week at the age of 67 resonated widely, but particularly amongst those who had known and loved her. One of those was Carmel MacDonald Byrne, the director of the Aisling Centre for Survivors of Institutional Abuse, which he co-founded with Christine. She spoke to Jonathan Clinch on Tuesday's News at One.
Came as a huge shock. I was actually with Christine last evening up to 10:30. She looked very peaceful. I said goodbye to her, and I said, I you know, I loved her, and I thanked her profusely for what she had done for all survivors, because she was asleep in the time frame that I had been visiting the hospital. So I just knew that I had to say this before I left. And then I was shocked then to hear of her sad demise this morning. I got a phone call around 7 o'clock this morning from the family, because as far as they were concerned, I was Christine's sister. Because we were always attached to the hip. Christine was the real strong, forceful one, and I was in the background, but we worked very well as a team.
And how did the pair of you first get in contact? How did you meet?
Well, what happened was I did a radio interview here in RTE with Pat Kenny early March 1996, just after the Dear Daughter documentary, and just gave my story about my family and losing my two siblings to a death, a drowning accident in Rosneola. And after the programme, I asked, could my number be passed on to Christine Buckley? And I spoke to her that evening and linked in with her the next day. From that, we were never separated. It was just like we've just like gelled together. We just had this thing that we connected. First of all, we both came from the same institution, Golden Bridge. Christine was there pre my time, but I always remembered her coming back as a past pupil to visit people, because she always thought about other people other than herself.
And what were your first impressions of Christine when you met up? Obviously, there was something in common you had there, some of that zeal, perhaps, that we could hear in that excerpt from the documentary.
I just knew that when I heard the documentary, Dear Daughter, first of all, I was just so relieved that the truth had come out, the truth that I had always told my friends, which I always tried to justify. But when I heard it in the Dear Daughter documentary, sitting with all of my friends, I just broke down and said, I'm always telling you the truth. Now you understand what we went through. And it was great that Christine, because I wasn't strong enough to do what Christine did. I mean, she's the most remarkable woman. And we don't realise yet what we have lost. So such a powerful, powerful person. And I hope she will never, ever be forgotten in this country.
How will you best remember her?
As my bestest ever friend, the most trustworthy, selfless person I've ever encountered in my life.
Carmel MacDonald Byrne talking to Jonathan Clinch on Tuesday's News at One. Later on Tuesday, a number of callers to Liveline also remembered the impact Christine Buckley had on their lives. One of those was Ray Nochter from Carlo.
I was taking my case in the High Court, and as you know, I was the first there to take the case. Christine was there, and she introduced herself to me and greeted me and wished me well. And she was a heart of gold, Joe, and she gave me great encouragement and great strength. And I think her presence there meant an awful lot to me. And it got me through the few days I was there, you know.
Because
it did.
Because it was very courageous what you did as well. And to go to court is an extraordinarily pressurised and difficult thing to do, and intimidating thing to do.
Of course, and I could have lost, Joe. I could have lost that case. But I have to say, Joe, because of the presence of Christine Buckley, made things that little bit easier for me. The way she spoke to me, she was so kind with her words and spoke so softly to me, and you know, didn't make me nervous whatsoever. She made me, to be honest, very, very comfortable. Very, and I wasn't a bit nervous after speaking to her, you know. And she was there for the couple of days, Joe, that I was there, and congratulated me when I did win. Mm-hmm. You know, because at the end of the day, Joe, that's what she was saying. All you have to do is go there, go up there, and tell the truth. You know, and that's exactly what I done. I had nothing to hide, you know.
Ray Nachter is heard on Liveline on Tuesday. Later on Drive Time, we also heard from journalist Justine McCarthy about her memories of Christine Buckley.
A couple of years ago, I remember bumping into her in a clothes shop. We were both rummaging through rails of clothes, and she told me she was looking for a special outfit because she was being conferred with an honorary doctorate in Trinity. That was in 2012, and she was very happy about it. But she didn't. We didn't spend long having the girly talk of you should try this dress on, that would be nice for you, because Christine, it always came back to the issue. She was utterly passionate about promoting the issue of child abuse. And she was a very nice, warm woman. She was very good company, but she was also very single-minded. She was very gritty. She was very gracious. And how gracious and forgiving she was. I had a great example of it because I met her many years ago when I was a very young journalist, way before she spoke to Gay Byrne on the radio. Another journalist introduced us. I met her in Bewley's Cafe in Westmoreland Street, and she told me some of what she went on to tell in the Louis Lenton and the Mary Raftery documentaries. And to my eternal shame, I didn't write that story.
She tried telling that story to many people through the 1980s. And part of probably the Irish psyche at the time was people went, could it possibly be true?
Well, first of all, it was such an overwhelming story. Where would you start? And it was a very secretive society in those days. And secondly, there was an element of, my goodness, this is almost unbelievable.
But she continued on.
She continued on. And when our paths crossed again many years later, I apologised to her. And she was so gracious. She accepted it. And she almost brushed it aside. And that was the measure of Christine.
Justine McCarthy talking to Mary Wilson on Tuesday's Drive Time. The resignation of Frank Flannery from his roles as director of the Rehab Group and director of elections and trustee of the Fine Gael Party was another big story on air this week. Before news of Mr. Flannery's resignations was announced, the Minister for Education, Rory Quinn, was talking to Kieran Shanley on the Today Show when she asked him if he felt that Mr. Flannery should resign from Fine Gael.
That's really a matter for the Fine Gael party. He's been actively involved in politics for as long as I can remember. He was involved with Gareth Fitzgerald. And it's a matter for them to decide and for him to decide.
What do you think yourself, then?
I really don't know, because I don't know all the facts. I understand he has been invited to attend the PAC. All charities that are in receipt of taxpayers' money have to be accountable for the dispersal of that money. And as we've seen from what happened with the Central Remedial Clinic, every charity has been damaged by the reduction, I would say, in trust because of the internal behaviour and the sense that governance is not accountable to the wider public. That's the PAC is charged in the Oireachtas. It has to be chaired by a member of the opposition, so it's not controlled by the government or the government parties of the day. And they're the watchdog for taxpayers' money.
Right. Minister, you were quoted the weekend saying you'd had no formal meetings with him. This is in regard to his role as a lobbyist for Rehab. But, you know, that you'd bumped into him along the corridors. Are you talking about informal meetings with him and those bumpings in the corridors?
Well, I've known Frank for a long number of years because of his involvement. And there is a corridor that ministers have office is on, which is at the back of government buildings linked to Leinster House proper. And I would be in there, we say, at 8:30 in the morning on the day of a cabinet meeting. And I would meet him, or I would see him walking past the odd time with usually Fine Gael advisers. And I would have greeted him, or I would have passed him.
And would you have been aware of any of his activities as a lobbyist for rehab? Would you have heard of him doing that, or would he ever have lobbied you yourself?
Well, he had spoken to me on different occasions about concerns they had over his change in the monies that were available to rehab as a result of the introduction of the National Lottery, but not in any kind of lobbying way to me.
But he had spoken to you, he had brought up issues of concern to rehab with you, yes, as serving Minister for Education.
Yeah.
The Minister for Education, Rory Quinn, talking to Kieran Shanley on Monday's Today Show. Later in the week, following news of Mr Flannery's resignation, Fergus Finlay was a panellist on Wednesday's Late Debate.
Somebody I've known for years, often in a competitive kind of way, but a friendly sort of way. Never somebody that, you know, did anything dishonourable to me or, you know, in political terms that I know of. But I'm still dumbfounded by what's happened here. I looked today at the Memorandum and Articles of Association of Rehab, the organisation of which he was chief executive for years, and therefore, I would suspect, had a hand in drawing them up, the organisation of which he was a board member. There is a clear statement within those memo and arts that prohibits a member of the board from taking paid employment with rehab. It's not possible. And yet, we discovered that he was drawing very considerable fees for, you know, paid employment on behalf of rehab.
For lobbying.
For lobbying. Mm-hmm. For lobbying around issues that were of interest to them. Now, if he was lobbying anybody as a member of the board or as chief executive of rehab about issues of concern to rehab or issues of concern to the wider disability movement, that's perfectly legitimate. If he's paid outside the terms of, outside the memo and arts of the organisation, inappropriately paid, to look after rehab's corporate interests, that's completely and absolutely beyond the pale, unacceptable. And it's a line that, you know, it's not a fine line. There's no subtle point here. It's a clear breach of his fiduciary responsibilities and his responsibilities to rehab. And to then do the same thing with Philanthropy Ireland, as chairman of Philanthropy Ireland, to go and lobby for money, for fees, the government, you know, whose viewpoint he wanted to influence legitimately, but to do it for fees, I just don't get it. I just can't understand how, in any scheme of things, that can be regarded as acceptable. So you've used the phrase several times that it's about perception. It's not. It's not about perception. This is wrong. It is taking, it's giving lobbying a bad name. It gives rehab a bad name, it gives Philanthropy Ireland a bad name, and it gives Frank Flannery a bad name, and it is just not acceptable.
Fergus Finlay on the Late Debate with Audrey Carvel on Wednesday. The publication of the Garda Inspectorate report received extensive coverage on air this week. Robert Olson, the author of that report, was in the Morning Ireland studio with Claire Byrne on Thursday.
Can we talk about corruption? Because your report says that rather than there being corruption involved here, as alleged by the whistleblowers, there's mismanagement. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, on the mismanagement, and I think we outlined it pretty well there, there was no audit trail at all. There was no, there were clear violations of policy. Nobody was making sure that that was happening. There was lost notes that just disappeared. There was the CNAG report also noted this stuff that we did. That's mismanagement. And I'd like
not,
to say,
it's
too,
not corruption?
The Garda Inspectorate's remit is not about investigating wrongdoing. We went in and did a inspection of the process, and we didn't go into, and it is not our role to do investigations of individual incidents that may or may not have been more than just mismanagement. That was not. There are other agencies. That's up to the commissioner. That's up to GSOC. I know there's a couple of investigations that the minister's got going now that will probably look into that and find it. But we didn't That wasn't the track of what we, the inspectorate's remit was
okay,
to do.
OK, but we know that a Garda number was used on the Pulse system to quash penalty points. That Garda had retired weeks earlier. We know that evidence of quashing points was shredded after it was done. So I'm wondering how you can, if it's not your job to find out whether there was corruption or not, how you can say that there wasn't corruption.
Well, I could say it because that's not what we'd looked for. And,
but you're
and
saying it's not your job to look for it.
It was a system failure. We didn't investigate and go in and say, yes, that person did that wrong thing, which is what really would have to be done on those incidents and why that happened. It's not for us to do, and we did not investigate why, as you just gave an example, of why were these documents shredded And I think it was, personally, it was mismanagement is why, because nobody was watching and making sure that those documents went, that had to be retained under the policy for later audit.
Chief Inspector of the Garda Inspectorate, Robert Olson, being interviewed by Claire Byrne on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Also on that same programme, Gavin Jennings spoke to retired Garda whistleblower John Wilson.
Garda Commissioner Callanan said yesterday that he wanted to clarify remarks that he had made about you and Maurice McCabe at the Public Accounts Committee earlier this year. He said, I want to clarify that my use of that term, as in disgusting, was not in reference to the character of either Sergeant McCabe or yourself, but the manner in which personal and sensitive data was inappropriately appearing in the public domain without regard to due process and fair procedures. I stated at the PAC and reiterate now, that's yesterday, my absolute support and commitment to any member of An Garda Síochána who reports wrongdoing of any kind. What do you have to say to that?
Absolutely untrue, Gavin. I have no doubt that Commissioner Callan was fully aware of the comments that he was making when he appeared before the PAC in relation to when he made the disgusting remarks. He was given multiple opportunities by Mary Lou MacDonald to withdraw the disgusting allegations, and I believe that the information contained in the document that he proffered yesterday to the media in the form of a press statement, I believe it makes matters worse, Gavin. He's now saying that we broke the law. I mean, he's now saying that we deliberately released personal and sensitive data into the public domain. We acted lawfully, Gavin, at all times, pursuant to Section 62 of the Garda Síochána Act 2005, which legally, Mr. Shatter, Mr. Callanan, entitles members of An Garda Síochána to approach members of bureaucracy with allegations of malpractice and corruption within the force.
Because Alan Shatter reiterated, or echoed to some extent, what Martin Callanan said when he said on 6-1 last night, there are serious issues around a member of An Garda Síochána liberally accessing confidential information on the Pulse system and distributing it to the general public, and that's a genuine ongoing difficulty and concern.
Gavin, you know, it'll come as no surprise to anybody in this country that Mr. Shatter his comments are very, very similar to those of Commissioner Callan. And the reality is, Gavin, here, that there were over 10,000 lawfully issued fixed charge penalty notices being terminated on a yearly basis in this country. And the vast majority of these tickets were corruptly terminated by senior members of the Garda Síochána. The fact that these numbers have now virtually collapsed, Gavin, you know, is further indication that the allegations that myself and Sergeant McCabe made were correct. And can I also say, Gavin, if you'll allow me to do so, I mean, Sergeant McCabe is still working under very, very strict conditions. He cannot use the Garda Síochána Pulse system. And, you know, Mr. Callanan should be proud to have a member of Sergeant McCabe's calibre in his policing service, not his force, in our policing service. And I'm now demanding that Commissioner Callanan restores Sergeant McCabe's full access to Pulse with immediate effect, and I'm making that request. I'm demanding that, Gavin, in the public interest.
Before we let you go, what would you say now to future whistleblowers, to Gardaí working today, who want to speak up about what they see as wrongdoing in their workplace? After what's happened to you and Garda McCabe, should they speak up or shut up?
Well, I'd say, Gavin, I mean, I'd always encourage members of Garda Síochána to come forward with, with their suspicions of malpractice or corruption within the force. But as long as Commissioner Callanan remains as the Garda Commissioner, I believe that you're not going to get too many guards coming forward reporting anything.
Retired Garda whistleblower John Wilson talking to Gavin Jennings on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Rural crime was the subject of two reports which Valerie Cox did for the Today Show this week. Valerie travelled to County Donegal, where there has been a spate of attacks since the beginning of the year. The good news, however, is that the community is beginning to fight back with a series of meetings and initiatives, such as a night patrol and a text alert system. Valerie spoke to John, an elderly farmer, who described how he was robbed recently, shortly after his nephew left his home.
It was about 3-4 seconds gone when the knock came to the door. And I got up and I turned the key and I thought it was my nephew's blackguard. And I said, somebody's going to get hurt at this crack. I saw the hoodies, like, you know. And I turned and walked down to the living room. And one of them turned me, put the gun to my head, and another boy pushed me back towards the couch. Another boy squeezed in past and he ransacked the room, the bedroom and the living room. And nothing else was touched. They were just, and they were locals. They knew exactly what they were looking for. They only whispered, no money. That's all was said, was no money. They stood me up then and took the phone out of my pocket. And I had 55 euro there in the left-hand pocket, a pocket I never carry money in. I didn't even know I had it. And the flap, they couldn't wait to get the button open. They ripped the button open and threw everything in my pocket.
Ripped your back pocket?
Ripped the back pocket. And but lucky enough, I had another phone, an old phone in the house, and I charged it. It took 5 minutes to charge it, and I dialed 999. And inside 7 minutes, the guards were on the doorstep. Very, very quick, that I must say now.
Were you frightened?
Not really, no. Not really, no. I thought it was my nephew's acting idiot. That's why it didn't dawn on me till later on, you know, till they put me down on the couch and put the pressure on the back of my neck and put the gun to the back of my ear. But it was only a toy gun. Sure, like the real thing, like, you know.
So it was realistic?
That was very realistic. Very realistic, yeah. After the ordeal, I took a heavy nosebleed.
And did they talk to you at all?
No, did not, no. The lad had done the raiding down the room. He came up and he whispered, no money. No money. That's all he said.
Do you think they were watching your nephew?
They were watching every move. They were watching every move. They knew exactly.
And how do you feel about living on your own now?
Oh, it doesn't take a shake out of me. I wouldn't let them vermin see they're getting through to me. No way.
From Valerie Cox's report on Wednesday's Today Show. Kirsty Wark, the presenter of BBC's Newsnight programme, was a guest on the John Murray Show on Thursday when she told John about the lead-up to an interview she once did with Margaret Thatcher.
I was the kind of principal political interviewer at BBC Scotland, and Downing Street had said that she was coming to Scotland and she would do an interview, and that really was that, you know, and we didn't really have much more conversation about it. Then when it became closer to the day, Downing Street suddenly realised I was doing the interview, and Mrs. Thatcher famously did not like being interviewed by women, and she put her foot down and said no, and Downing Street demanded that I be taken off it, and the BBC stood absolutely foursquare in front of me and behind me and around me and said no. If Mrs. Thatcher's doing an interview, you don't get to decide who does the interview. The BBC decides who does the interview. And so they stuck to their guns and I did the interview. And it was, I mean, we did a huge, I mean, as you very well know, you know, I did a great brainstorm with my producer and researchers and we prepared the interview. And, you know, I only had half an hour. She tried to deflect me a couple of times. But I just,
what do you, when you say she tried to deflect you? Tell us about that.
Well, what happened was that, I mean, she knew I was a feminist. And so on occasion, she started an answer and I realised what she was doing was trying to get me onto an issue, which was very important, but it was an issue particularly not for this interview. It was an issue about, I can't even remember what it was, but some kind of women, a very important issue for women. But I knew exactly what she was doing. And so I just steered the interview straight back onto the line which we wanted to pursue. But the problem is Mrs. Thatcher could never understand why she was so unpopular in Scotland, because basically what people did in Scotland was they did embrace the policy, particularly of buying the council houses. They embraced that, but they didn't really thank her for it. And she really couldn't understand why she got no political gain from it at all. But her advisers had said to her before the interview, you have to, I think, be more sympathetic. I don't know what it was. But she started in the interview saying, now, you know, we in Scotland this and we in Scotland that. And I thought, this is the most bonkers thing I've ever heard. No, we in Scotland, what do you mean?
Yes.
And there was a kind of, I asked one question, which was that, you know, that kind of question where there is no real answer, where I said, do you understand, Mrs. Thatcher, why people in Scotland find you so patronising? So she could either say, yes, I do understand, or no, I don't. So it was one of those kind of carefully constructed questions.
Oh, and why do you think she didn't like being interviewed by women?
I don't know, was it a chemistry that she felt when she was being interviewed by men? She didn't, as far as I could understand, surround herself by women very much at all. She wasn't a woman who then sort of pulled women up behind her, you know, the great, the lean in, the Sheryl Sandberg thing about, you know, women have a duty to, you know, encourage other women. That was never her position. She had a predominantly, completely male cabinet, really, except for Virginia Bottomley, I think, at one point. And I don't think she was actually in the cabinet. And She never saw it as a role. She was much happier around men, and I didn't think she knew the coordinates of being interviewed by a woman, especially not in politics and especially not in Scotland.
Kirsty Wark as heard on Thursday's John Murray Show. It's 3 years since the civil war in Syria began. We heard a number of reports on air this week about the ongoing conflict in which 140,000 people have died. And on Wednesday's Drive Time, we heard from a Syrian woman living in Ireland who didn't wish to be named. She spoke to Brian Lally.
I still have my father and the rest of my family in Syria. They're in the northern part, so-called free part of Syria. So I'm in a very infrequent contact with them due to the situation. The phone lines are completely down. It's heart-wrenching, really it is, because not only is my family there, but you just feel for all the people. You know, people, obviously, you don't know, for all the children, innocent children, women, families. It's very difficult to watch. And it's the worst thing is that, you know, no, there is no outcry, unlike what we had in Bosnia in 1990s and Rwanda, when these massacres happened and when there was a siege of Sarajevo. There was a massive outcry, even though people had no idea what was happening. They could see, they could relate that where what is happening in Syria is even worse. It's at a larger scale. We have over 3 million refugees. It's the biggest crisis. And the worst thing is, you know, international community doesn't seem to care. The atrocities are so big and terrible that sometimes people questioning, are they real? Can it be that real? And I think I'm trying to justify it in that. But really, it's been 3 years, over 3 years. People are literally starving. They're dying from hunger. And all of the governments across the Europe and the world, I keep saying, let's negotiate. Let's do it. Let's patience. Even our Taoiseach Eamon Gilmore is asking for patience.
Tell me about the Syria that you know. I mean, we hear the names on the TV. We hear about Aleppo and we hear about Homs and we hear about Damascus. Tell me a bit about your Syria.
Well, it's the Syria, for me, is the scent of jasmine. It's an ancient country with a beautiful, rich culture, a beautiful food, with people who are the warmest, so welcoming. I remember, you know, my father saying that before the war, he came across Spanish tourists. They stayed with him on a farm, you know, camping there for 10 days. He kept cooking for them and everything. And that's normal behavior. You know, he never met them. You know, it's a normal. And what about the historical damages? I remember in Aleppo, there is this beautiful citadel and old town in Aleppo and Damascus, old souks or markets, as you like. That's all gone. But the worst thing is really, it's humanitarian loss. You know, what will happen with those people, with those generations of people? They're going to ask us, where were you when the war happened in Syria? Yeah, I know we can't do much, but we should all voice our concern. And Ireland has lost so many millions, you know, in the famine. And I think Irish should identify with what is happening in Syria, where people are really surviving on olives and herbs.
Brian Lally talking to a Syrian woman living in Ireland on Wednesday's Drive Time. Our own humanitarian crisis is how the living conditions on a halting site in Blackpool in Cork were described this week. Today's show reporter Brian O'Connell was given a tour around one of the mobile homes owned by a resident of the Spring Lane halting site.
Just going into the back of my mobile home. I have 7 kids altogether. I have 3 boys living in the caravan here at the back, as you can see. But a bank here at the back, a cliff is falling down, as you can see here from yourself. The cliff is falling down on top of the caravan. I've been reporting it nearly every single day to the council and to the caretaker, Jerry.
So I can see, like, there's quite a steep cliff of maybe 15, 20 feet high, and you can see, obviously, that the soil has come away and there's
It's gradually going and going, and, you know, with the last few weeks back with the bad weather, it's been falling and falling bit by bit gradually. We've no showers, we've no bathrooms. At night, we have to bring a basin in for the kids to use it. You want the best for your kids, not the worst.
And would you like to stay living on the site if it was properly kitted out?
If it was properly kitted out, I suppose I wouldn't mind. But the way it is at the moment, living conditions are very bad. There's potholes there. There's rats, there's mice. I have a caravan in there. I woke up in the morning and there were snails on the floor. As you can see there, have a look with your own two eyes. I have duct tape around my window. And I have a cot in there. I'll bring it in and I'll show it to where my baby is sleeping inside.
This is the front door of the main mobile home, yeah. I'd say.
This is my bedroom here. I have myself and my two little girls sleeping in here in this bedroom with me. This is the window.
So this is the window you were showing me from the outside with, yeah, the duct tape.
With the duct tape.
And I can see all around the window there is evidence of dampness.
This is the cot my baby sleeps in.
At the bottom of the cot, it's just full of mildew and dampness.
There's snails crawling in like all around the place. And we have to put up with this. This is basically it, like what we're living in. We've no water, no toilets, no showers, nothing. This balcony, I had to get it put up myself. My child fell out the door. I had blocks there. My child fell out the door and lost four of the front teeth over it. We're just nothing in the council's eyes, like I suppose, like dirt in their eyes. They don't think nothing of us.
From Brian O'Connell's report on the Today Show on Wednesday. The racing at Cheltenham, of which Ireland had a pretty impressive 12 wins, received lots of coverage on air this week. My favourite bits are the interviews done with the jockeys and trainers just minutes after their horses have ridden to victory. This was Barry Geraghty just after he won the Ladbrokes World Hurdle, and more of that on Thursday.
He is still a bit of a baby, but he jumped and travelled and he was always going well.
He's only had 5 races.
That's all. And he still is a little bit innocent. He was innocent on front after the last, but he's got an engine.
What was it like? You jumped upside Danny Power. Talk us through the last 200 yards.
Well, when we turned in and Ruby joined me, I wasn't sure how well he was going, but as he gave his mare a squeeze, I always felt it had the upper hand.
Great feeling.
Brilliant.
It was also a particularly good week for trainer Jim Cullity, who himself once rode the Cheltenham Gold Cup and Grand National winners in the same season. Here he is after his horse, Spring Heeled, won the Kinmuir Challenge Cup on Thursday.
Unbelievable. He's a bit fractious as a young horse. I've always thought the world of him. Because he's a bit of a worrier and things, and as a result of that and me giving him time to mature and things, he's just ended up well handicapped. So we came here, I think, 24 runners. I thought, if things fall his way, I think he's got a right chance, but you need a lot of luck. There was no luck required there. Once he was off, once he jumped to first, I said, well, this is unbelievable. I couldn't ask for a better soft lead, right jockey on his back to give him an absolute peach from the front. Like, I mean, it was just, you saw yourself, poetry in motion. He was the winner from the time he jumped to first. Like, you could pick him out as the winner. Like.
And this was Jim Cullity on Friday after his horse, Lady Windermere, won the much coveted Gold Cup. Commentary beforehand is by Tony O'Hare.
Lord Windermere. And on his own as they race towards the line. It's going to be desperately close. Lord Windermere wins the Gold Cup from on his own in second.
Well, to be fair now, halfway around, Davy Russell was getting the sack. But Davy rode him last time and rode him handy in a false run race. And he came in, well, we were all disgusted, like. And he came in and said, take, with a smile on his face, after getting beaten 25 lengths, and he said to Dr. Lamb, take no notice of that, it'll be a different ball game in Cheltenham. And I knew he was going to take his time and kind of ride into his place and all that, but, like, that was waiting tactics exaggerated. Quite literally, I can't believe it.
As well as the jockeys and trainers, we also heard from some gamblers on the airwaves this week. On Wednesday's Today Show, we heard from a group who Paddy O'Gorman met in a pub in Dundalk the previous day. Paddy asked them how much they had just placed on the last race.
I had 500 each way on the new one there. I lost 25 euro on it because it got 130, but I backed them anti-post at 4-1, you know.
But how did you only lose 25 euro then?
Because you returned at 130.
But when you say 500 each way, that means you put 1,000 euro.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, you got 925 back.
Yeah. I lost 75 euro.
And because he came in third each way, you
got
back.
Yeah, but he should have won. He was a definite third. If O'Connor didn't fall and bring him down, he would have won. So I'm waiting now till Friday. My next big bet is I'm having 2,000 euro win on Briar Hill at 2-1. Which means I only lost 75. But if I had it won, I was putting the whole lot on Covega. I back Covega anyway, but my big bet is Friday. I'm going to hold on till Friday and Briar Hill.
Have you a docket there on the next one, or have you...
I got a double up there, yeah. I find my docket now. I Covega and the last one are 750 double.
You got
750 there? Double number 3 in the 335 on Curvega. So it pays. It's paying in around 2,300 euro.
Next week, no, it's all over.
And then the wife kicks us out.
No, hold on. Next week, it's all over. But that's when it starts for me and him. We're going to save to be there next year.
All right.
Going to be part of that Irish Brigade next year.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we're going with the cowboy hats, the Trevor Madole look, we're going.
Are you back to work next week?
I took the week off.
At the moment, I'm unemployed. I'm doing small £5 bets and £2 bets, you know.
Would you be up or down most years?
This past 2 years, been down. No point telling lies, I've been down. But I thought I would have got off to a flyer this week, but it's not going to plan. So I'm thinking Friday might get me out of a hole with Briar Hill.
Does your wife worry about you at all?
Very much, yeah. She don't like it. She doesn't like it. I just take the week out with the boys and what goes on, you know.
And what does your wife say to you?
About the gambling. Mm. She doesn't like it. I try to block it out as much as I can, you know. Tell her lies more than anything. See, I have 3 kids at home, so they'll probably watch it on the telly anyway. She knows my bets anyway. They're 10 each way best to her, but they're 500 each way to me. A gambler always tell lies.
From Paddy O'Gorman's report on the Today Show on Wednesday. John Banville was a guest on Arena on Tuesday. Since 2006, he's been writing crime novels under the name of Benjamin Black. And now, on the instigation of his agent, Benjamin Black is writing a new Philip Marlowe novel, who, as you'll probably know, is the creation of crime writer extraordinaire Raymond Chandler. The novel is called The Black-Eyed Blonde. Sean Rocks asked John Banville where the name came from.
Well, I was about a quarter of the way through the book when my agent remembered that he had a list of titles that Chandler himself had, he kept them aside for possible use in the future. And one of them was The Black-Eyed Blonde. My agent said, wouldn't this be a great title? And I said, yes, it would. So I adopted that. And I then had to go back and change the woman's, Claire Cavendish's hair colour and colour of her eyes. But that was easy to do. It was a great title, Black-Eyed Blonde. If somebody had said to me even 15 years ago, John, someday you'll write a book called The Black-Eyed Blonde, I would have said, you're mad. But it was a great adventure, as I said at the start, a great adventure, and I enjoyed it.
So has your attitude then changed to what the crime writing, what purpose it serves within your own career?
Well, Benjamin Black was born out of the fact that I began to read George Simenon, whom I hadn't read before, and I started to read him about 2003. And when I discovered what Simenon could do with, you know, very, very small vocabulary, very plain style, a lot of dialogue, strong characters, I thought, yeah, I'll have a go at this. So that was where Benjamin Black came from. And, you know, I was turning 60. Again, I was looking for an adventure. And being Benjamin Black seemed the largest adventure I could embark on. Look, maybe it was a mistake. Maybe it will prove to be a mistake in the end, but I don't care. The older I get, the more playful I get, the more irresponsible I get.
John Banville talking to Sean Rocks on Tuesday's Arena. That's about my lot for this week. George Lee is up next with the business. Dave Geraghty from Bell X1 played live on Wednesday's Arena. His new music project is called Join Me in the Pines. This is At First Light. I'm Fiona Kelly. Happy St. Patrick's Day. So until next week, goodbye.
Long time waiting on her phone. I set reminders to plug it up from where we left off last time. My faith lies in knowing just how wrong I've been before and for so long. I'm sending flares until first light. First light. Baby, are you feeling warm? Out on the limb of his arms, I can't tell if you're breathing under there. Baby, are you feeling warm? Hanging out there with his charms, setting off smoke alarms, waking the house at first light. catch whatever lives we can when we're not busy making other plans. Don't let what's real to you pass you by. We've gotten older now, it's all we've got. Falling in love is for a clumsy heart. I watch the skies till slumber has me fall.